The Guardian.
I'm Rowena Mason, The Guardian's deputy political editor. This is Politics Weekly.
This is not an anti-European party. This is not an anti-European country. We are European. We love Europe. I love Europe anyway. I love it. But after 45 years of really dramatic constitutional change in our relationships, we must have a new relationship with the EU, a positive and confident partnership, and we can do it. And today in Brussels, we are tabling what I believe are constructive and reasonable proposals.
We are here at Conservative Party Conference today in Manchester, where Boris Johnson has just delivered his speech, promising to deliver Brexit and trying to position himself as a one-nation politician who will champion the NHS. I'm with Heather Stewart, The Guardian's political editor, for some instant reaction to that speech. Heather, can you tell us what you made of it?
Well, there wasn't very much content. There wasn't any detailed new policy. There were scant details even of the Brexit offer, the sort of final offer to the EU, which was sort of trailed overnight as the centrepiece of the speech. What there was a really clear sense of the territory on which Boris Johnson wants to fight the next general election when it comes, which we're expecting to be within months, perhaps even within a few weeks. He was positioning himself absolutely as someone who will spend more money on public services, on schools, on hospitals. He talked about the NHS at length.
We're not only recruiting more doctors and nurses and training them, but in the next 10 years, we will build 40 new hospitals in the biggest investment in hospital infrastructure for a generation.
He talked about being very tough on crime, and there were a lot of sort of attacks on Jeremy Corbyn, rather sort of light-hearted attacks, you know, dismissing him as a sort of Russian communist cosmonaut who could be dispatched into space on some sort of UK space programme.
He wants an election now. or that is what he was going to say. Poor fella.
You know, lots of talk about how radical, dangerous Labour's policies are. So it felt more like a sort of tub-thumping pre-election speech, really, than a sort of solid programme for government in any sense.
And are voters going to believe him on this idea that he's going to spend more money on public services, given that we've had 10 years now, almost, of a Conservative government that's been wedded to austerity and cutting spending on public services?
Well, I think that's the really big question. Will voters be able to see or feel any of this new expenditure in time for a general election? Will they trust the Conservatives? And is Boris Johnson a fresh enough face? I think his supporters think, you know, he wasn't in government, he wasn't in cabinet at the time when most of those spending decisions were being made. He was out there being Mayor of London, so he was sort of somewhat distant from it. And he was the man, of course, most closely associated with that very controversial 350 million quid for the NHS slogan on the side of the Vote Leave bus. So I think the hope would be people think, oh, this is something Boris Johnson's always been in favour of. And certainly he seems to be visiting a hospital almost daily at the moment. There are pictures of him touring hospitals and meeting staff. But you're right, this is a party that has imposed swinging cuts on Britain for a generation or you know, for a decade, and many voters will have seen the effects of that in their local community.
And this attempt to position himself as a darling of the one nation centrist side of the party, how do you square that with him having kicked out 21 of the most one nation MPs from his party over his Brexit policy and some of the divisive, quite nationalist right-wing rhetoric that he's been using in trying to position himself as the people's politician against Parliament?
Well, it's very hard to square, isn't it? And I was struck, I thought, by the fact that the language in this speech was a little bit less jingoistic and a little bit less sort of bull in the china shop than some of the phrases he was using. He used the word, the phrase surrender bill, which is his name for the backbench bill that would force him to request a Brexit extension if he can't get a deal by the 19th of October. But he didn't return to any of that really belligerent language. And there were several attacks on Parliament, but they were couched in slightly jokey terms. You know, if it was a reality TV show, we'd all have been voted out of the jungle, ha-ha, which is quite different, really, to this, what certainly some Labour MPs felt was a slightly sort of sinister undertone to some of this rhetoric, which makes you wonder slightly whether he's realised realised that that's not the way to go. The general tone of this speech was quite sort of upbeat and optimistic and patriotic, I think, rather than, yeah, jingoistic. There was a passage in his speech where he said, this is not an anti-European party. I'm not anti-European. I love Europe, which, given that he came to the leadership with the support of the hardline European research group, the Steve Bakers and the Marc Francois, was perhaps slightly jarring. But actually, he did get a round of applause for that, which I thought was quite interesting. So it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't sort of classic themes of Thatcher and so on. He was trying to challenge his audience a little bit, but they love it. They lap it up. And the general, I don't know what you think, but the general sense here is of a pretty unified party, albeit by chucking out some of the people who disagree, that's absolutely champing at the bit for an election.
Yes, I absolutely agree that the mood here among activists is pretty optimistic and excited about Boris Johnson's leadership, perhaps to the extent of denial that there's a really kind of quite severe constitutional national crisis coming up within weeks over whether Boris Johnson's going to manage to get a Brexit deal and whether he will then go on to ignore the Benn Law. And I just wonder whether you think he can get away with a speech like this that is light on content and it is light on strategy and policy for the kind of immediate next few weeks when he's facing such an important national moment.
You know, I think often these things are judged with hindsight. And I think if we get through this extraordinary sort of high stakes gamble of the next few weeks of negotiations and trying to get a deal, and then if you don't get a deal, trying to somehow style out the Benn Law and not extend, if all of that ends without disaster, people will say, you know, here was Johnson setting the agenda for an extraordinary period in which he was going to, you know, take us out of the EU. If it all goes to pieces, people will look back and say, goodness me, look at that rambling load of old nonsense.
Heather, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In a week where the Conservatives have been haunted by allegations of prime ministerial scandal, Boris Johnson sent what he said was his final Brexit offer to the EU, a plan which has been dubbed Two Borders, 4 Years. The DUP is apparently on board with the plan, the EU not so much.
Yes, this is a compromise by the UK, and I hope very much that our friends understand that and compromise in their turn. Because if we fail to get an agreement because of what is essentially a technical discussion on the exact nature of future customs checks, when that technology is improving the whole time, then let us be in no doubt, conference, of what the alternative is. The alternative is no deal.
Johnson and the rest of the Tories had hoped that a bunch of policy changes announced over the 4-day conference would win favour with the voters. But with news of allegations that the Prime Minister once groped a journalist when he was editor of The Spectator surfaced only days after he came under pressure for allegedly failing to declare close personal links to entrepreneur Jennifer Arcuri while London Mayor, all of which had Tory ministers ducking for cover from prying questions. So what now? Will the EU accept his final offer? Can Johnson force a no-deal Brexit on the 31st if they don't, in the face of the Benn Act blocking a no-deal Brexit? And how can the Tories focus when their leader is in a perpetual state of controversy? We'll get into all that and more with our panel in Manchester in this week's Politics Weekly. Now, I am joined in a corner of the press room by Lisa O'Carroll, The Guardian's Brexit correspondent, and guests from two different wings of the Conservative Party, Ryan Shorthouse of the Conservative think tank Bright Blue, which is on the One Nation side of the party, and Kate Andrews of the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is on the more right-wing free marketeer end. Now, let's just start by having a look at the mood of conference. We're in a phase now where the Brexiteers and the free marketeers seem to be in the ascendancy in government and the One Nation bloc is firmly on the back benches. Kate, does it feel like that to you? And what's your sense of how Boris Johnson's premiership is going down among the activists and on the fringes?
Well, I've heard a real mixed bag of reviews, actually, speaking to a few journalists and delegates about how they think the party is feeling at the moment. But in the Think Tent Marquee, which the IEA and the Taxpayers Alliance co-run at party conference, it has been absolutely packed with grassroots who seem very excited and exhilarated, really, by what they think could happen in this kind of Conservative Party. Lots of calls for tax cuts, lots of calls for genuine reforms to things like the planning system that I don't think have been on the agenda for a long time. So I think that, you know, there's always a sense of wariness, especially given the fact that we're basically living in a lame duck parliament right now. But there was a lot of excitement for some of the ideas coming out of this Conservative Party.
And Ryan, what's your sense of things? Is there a different mood from previous year? And is there any way back for the One Nationers?
I don't really buy your premise, actually, that you know, this Boris cabinet is full of libertarians. I think there's always been a tension between your sort of freedom fighters and your socially conscious communitarians. And Boris does have people like Dominic Raab and Priti Patel, who are very much on the libertarian wing. But then also, you know, in Downing Street, you have people like Tim Montgomery, who is now the social justice advisor, Danny Kruger, his political secretary. And the announcements this week, for example, the increase in the minimum wage, the increased investment in new hospitals, don't sort of show that it's completely libertarian turbocharge. You know, and the other thing to say is that there is a feeling that because Brexit is seen as quite hardline, that, you know, he's going to have to compensate for that with more sort of one nation centrist domestic policies. So I don't think it's as clear cut as what you originally suggested.
Moving on to Brexit, the Prime Minister is going to be presenting his plans today, his revised Brexit proposal to the EU. Lisa, you're the expert on this. Two borders, 4 years, it's a catchy type of suggestion, but it's a hugely complex concept and there are lots of other elements to it that you've been reporting on. What exactly do we think Johnson's going to be proposing to Brussels?
Well, looking at it this morning after the kind of leak to the Telegraph and we got our own little bit last night in relation to the DUP and this notion of a double backstop that would give Dublin Belfast oversight after a period. I look at it again this morning and look at it, this is actually the withdrawal agreement with a ripped up backstop or a pared down backstop or a backstop with a time limit. Essentially, that's what it is. So for people who aren't familiar with it, it's essentially an offer to leave the EU on the 31st of October, but keep the transition period as originally envisaged intact to the end of December, and then on January the 1st, 2021, Great Britain and Northern Ireland, the UK in its entirety, will move out of the customs union, but Northern Ireland will remain in all the other areas, most significantly regulatory alignment for trading of agri-food and manufacturing, which means there will be no checks on the border on animals or food. But the controversial thing, of course, is that it would mean customs checks on the border. So what's interesting about that is, number one, that's very unacceptable, excuse me, to the Irish government, and they've more or less said that overnight. And two, Boris Johnson denied it 48 hours ago. So it says something about his credibility. I mean, this morning we're looking at the EU being very critical, saying it hasn't got a chance. And there's a possibility that this proposal will be dead on arrival. I think the EU will be more courteous than that, but that's what it's looking like.
And Kate, we heard overnight that the DUP do seem to be on board with the plan. If it gets to this point and the EU think there's some chance of potentially negotiating a deal, what do you think the chances are that Eurosceptics in the European Research Group will also get on board with this plan?
I think there's a chance that they could. I think it's a backstop with a time limit is a very good way of summarizing it. And I think Boris Johnson's bigger problem is going to be the EU, because it does seem like these two borders that would be propped up, even, of course, if checks were happening away from the border. And I think that would be ideal in almost every circumstance, just crosses every red line that the European Union's already set up. In terms of the hardline Brexiteers in the Conservative Party, I've heard from quite a few MPs who were a never may kind of MP who voted against her withdrawal agreement on every occasion, that times have changed and they are more receptive to getting something over the line because they're seeing the way that Brexit is now tearing up every institution, every aspect of Parliament. First and foremost, the Conservative Party, as we're, you know, seeing that split. The concern, I actually think, for the Conservatives is going into a general election. If you did, say, in some amazing scenario, get a deal and it had a time-limited backstop, would the Brexit Party supporters think that that was a Brexit delivered? Nigel Farage has changed his tune on this and now said that any kind of time-limited backstop is still not good enough. So there you'd have to see the competition. My suspicion is that if the Conservative Party gets a deal and enables us in any way to talk about anything other than Brexit, it will probably go down pretty well with MPs and with voters.
And Ryan, if the EU don't go for this plan, or if MPs don't go for this plan, where does that leave us on October the 31st?
Well, God knows, really, is the frank answer. I mean, interestingly, some more centrist MPs and policymakers are thinking about the EU playing hardball and saying, actually, we'll grant you an extension but only for a very short period of time, and that is to pass that withdrawal agreement. If you don't pass, you're going for a no-deal situation. And of course, what a lot of Theresa May's advisers and Boris' advisers have always wanted is to push MPs into that binary vote. There is no other option other than voting for a deal or no deal. And in that circumstance, it may be that the majority, when there is no other route, an extension or anything else, there's no other route, you go for a deal. So actually, you know, the different scenarios that are played out, one that is forgotten is that the EU could play hardball and force on Parliament to make that choice between a withdrawal agreement, whatever iteration of it, and a no deal. And it may be that that gets the deal over the line.
It's very difficult, though, to set up this binary vote between a deal and a no deal, given that MPs have voted for the Benn Law, which is mandating the Prime Minister to go and seek an extension from the EU if he hasn't managed to get a deal through Parliament. But the Prime Minister is confident that he's going to leave on October the 31st regardless. Do you think, Lisa, that there is any opportunity for the Prime Minister to kind of exploit any loopholes? Is it possible for him to just ignore that law?
Well, all the commentary up to now is that he can't, that he'll land himself on court on that Monday morning following the 19th of October deadline, and by which time he has to, under the Benn Act, to apply for an extension to Article 50. There is a theory that he will be defiant, that he will voluntarily land himself in court, metaphorically speaking, of course, and see battles over the 31st of October run for, with urgent court cases running until the very end, and burnish his credentials even more as the Brexit martyr, and stay in, asking for that extension at the last minute. But as Ryan says, God only knows what's going to happen. I think what's interesting, though, in the last week or so, I spent nearly a month in Ireland and spoke to a lot of people. So on the EU side, and of course we had Boris Johnson over there, we had Pence over there, we had Javid over there, and very much got the sense that the EU were showing that flexibility that Boris Johnson had asked them. There were strong indications that they would sort of crowbar open the withdrawal agreement slightly. So it looked like the space had been opened to create a deal, and I think a lot of this week has been about language, and it's about the domestic audience, about Boris Johnson being as hardline as possible to his parliamentary colleagues that he needs, and to the country. One of the problems is there are 2-3 conversations going on here at the very time when we need negotiations to focus on a single issue, which is obviously getting a Brexit deal, which everybody wants.
Okay, what do you think about the politics of a Boris Johnson pursuing a people versus parliament type of election? Is that a dead cert to be successful, or is that a pretty risky strategy at a time?
Everything's a risky strategy these days, I think. Look, it's got possibility, but I think it's very hard to roll back from a do-or-die comment. And he has said that we are leaving on the 31st of October. He will not ask for an extension. It was quite funny in the last panel of the think tent last night. City AM's Christian May was in conversation with the Chancellor, and Christian said, "I've heard from several of your colleagues that there are roughly 5 loopholes to the Benn Act," to which the Chancellor responded, "Only 5. And, you know, they are trying to imply that they will do everything they can not to ask for that. But there are 2 major issues here. One is the political issue for Boris Johnson, if he has to go into a general election, having promised not to ask for that extension, and then he extends. You know, you're going to have the photos of Theresa May asking for the extension next to Boris Johnson. It really will be bad from a PR perspective. But you also have the European Union, which have made it very, very clear that they do not want to grant an extension without something changing, because they're also tired of this, you know, perpetual state of asking an extending and asking and extending. Something's got to give. Now, whether or not they would extend it for, say, a second referendum, a general election, Ryan's, you know, thought about, you know, deal or no deal, anything could happen at this point. And obviously the EU want the deal, they want the money, they want the security. Something has to give soon, though, right?
Even if this deal was agreeable to Ireland and to Brussels, let's imagine that for a minute, is it possible that the EU would deliver a deal into the environment that we saw last week in Parliament? They will need to guarantee the ERG, the DUP, it looks like, are on board, but Labour rebels as well, just in case.
That's a really good point. I mean, I think the EU quite rightly keeps saying, what does the UK want? And Parliament is not able to agree on anything that it actually wants.
Now, outside of Brexit issues, the Prime Minister was forced to defend his own personal actions on a couple of fronts this week. At the end of last week, questions were raised about his motives when awarding some public money to companies of a businesswoman and close friend Jennifer Arcuri when he was London mayor. He denies wrongdoing and insists everything was done with full propriety. He also denies allegations by journalist Charlotte Edwards. Ryan, is there any sense that the Conservatives have lost control of conference at the beginning of it and that it started to get a bit overshadowed by some of these allegations? Or did it feel differently on the conference floor?
At our fringe events, it's not really coming up. I don't sense delegates are particularly interested in Boris's personal life. These things, I think, should be properly investigated. They're very serious, particularly, in my view, the use of taxpayers' money. But obviously, the Conservative Party has talked for a long time about fiscal discipline and using taxpayers' money properly. So if Boris is found to have not done that while he was at City Hall, then that could be a problem. But my honest view is that actually more people are talking about what's going to happen with Brexit than Boris's personal life.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together we can fight for a better one. Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly from the Conservative Party Conference. While we've all been in Manchester, my colleague Peter Walker has stayed in London to get a sense of how the opposition is getting on with cross-party talks to stop a no-deal Brexit. And it looks like they aren't seeing eye to eye at the minute.
We simply cannot afford to wait until the 19th of October to see whether or not the Prime Minister will refuse to obey the law again.
This crisis can only be settled with a general election.
We think a people's vote is the way forward. Obviously, the other alternative is a general election.
That election needs to take place as soon as this government's threat of a disastrous no deal is taken off the table.
And if there is a general election, Liberal Democrats stand absolutely ready to take on both Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn because our country deserves better.
Basically, the opposition parties decided to vote against the idea of having a brief suspension of Parliament while the Tory conference was going on. So they've kind of had free rein, but they've been slightly limited in what they can do. They've been mainly talking amongst themselves about the various ways in which they can try and stop a no-deal Brexit. So when it comes to a no-confidence vote, the SNP were reportedly quite keen, but the other opposition parties really weren't, because the problem is, obviously, is that once you have a no-confidence vote, under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, it triggers this kind of formal 14-day process whereby you don't have an election, you just get a chance for another government to be formed. And the worry is that if there weren't plans already in place and if there wasn't already a guaranteed extension to Brexit, then Boris Johnson could basically use that period just to run down the clock. So after talks between the parties, the decision very, very much was that they're not going to go for a vote of no confidence until they're absolutely sure that an extension to Brexit beyond October 31st is actually in place. When it comes to the idea of a government of national unity, there is a bit of a disagreement basically between Labour and, well, certainly the Liberal Democrats and possibly some of the other parties. The Liberal Democrat idea would be a genuine cross-party government of national unity. The thing to stress is that this would only be brought into play as a kind of last-ditch thing if it looked like Boris Johnson was trying to somehow do something dubious legally or try to run down the clock such that he would try and get no deal on October 31st. And that would be when the opposition parties would trigger a motion of no confidence. And the idea is they have to have an alternative government kind of oven ready, kind of ready to kind of go into place. And a Lib Dems idea would be something cross-party led by a backbench grandee. I mean, names raised have been Ken Clark, Harriet Harman, people like that. Whereas Labour are kind of absolutely adamant about the idea that it can only be basically a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour government, which they say would be really, really limited by time. The problem is that, as the Lib Dems point out, they don't think that there's enough votes in Parliament to put Jeremy Corbyn into number 10, even for that short a period.
There is no way he can unite rebel Conservatives and independents to stop Boris Johnson. It's not even certain he would secure all the votes of Labour MPs. This isn't about personalities. This is about having a plan that actually works.
There's been a certain focus on the disagreements between the opposition parties, but it's worth stressing that throughout this, they could, you know, they have arguably used this week fairly well. On Monday, they had talks between all the opposition party leaders. They've had talks between the party whips since then. They've agreed basically on most things. They've agreed not to go for the no confidence vote. They've agreed not to go for this Lib Dem pushed idea to try and have an earlier deadline whereby Boris Johnson would have to seek a later Brexit date. You know, there is obviously this big looming issue about what sort of government of national unity would have to be in place. So the big question is, obviously, if there is this looming idea of a no-deal Brexit, if Boris Johnson metaphorically barricades himself inside Number 10, will this kind of big issue over who would lead a government of national unity, could they resolve that? And it's basically difficult to tell. The SNP seem keener on the idea of Jeremy Corbyn running a very, very time-limited temporary government more than the Lib Dems. Jo Swinson, the Lib Dem leader, has to an extent painted herself into a corner because she's been completely adamant she would never, ever allow Jeremy Corbyn to do this. And Labour's argument is that, you know, he's the leader of by far the biggest opposition party, so he's got the right to kind of try first. And it's very, very difficult to see where it would go. However, if the option, you know, was a no-deal Brexit, then presumably someone would need to blink first. It's just a question of, you know, who would do that.
Thanks, Peter. Well, I'm still here in Manchester with my panel, Lisa O'Carroll, Ryan Shorthouse and Kate Andrews, to discuss some of the policies being floated here. While Johnson was busy denying the allegations made about him, his ministers were making speeches ahead of a possible general election, promising investment in several areas such as education, defence, health and transport. Chancellor Sajid Javid attempted to woo Labour voters by announcing that if kept in power, the Conservatives would raise the national living wage from £8.21 an hour to £10.50 an hour by 2024. And Labour's Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell called this announcement a pathetic attempt at catch-up, as his party had already pledged to raise the national living wage to £10 an hour by 2020 and to include all workers under 18. Javid also said the Tories will spend millions on tackling homelessness, more funding for the NHS, rebuilding the high street, improving fast broadband access and improving roads and bus services. Now, Kate, what did you make of those announcements? Were any of them radical enough to win over voters at a general election?
It was very much an election-based speech, election-based giveaways. People like spending and very often don't want to think about how they'll have to pay for it down the road. But I thought it was a real mixed bag and was very disappointed in many aspects that a chancellor who, you know, I think pretty much for his history in Parliament has been very committed to fiscal responsibility, went on a bit of a spending spree. The National Living Wage one worries me most because the minimum wage was thoughtfully designed and controlled by the Low Pay Commission intentionally to make sure that it wouldn't have any kind of damaging impact on jobs. And when former Chancellor George Osborne took it out of the hands of the Low Pay Commission and brought it into Parliament, a lot of people warned, including the IA, that it would become a political football around election time. Who could pledge more? And lo and behold, we're coming up to an election period, and the Labour Party and the Conservative Party are doing just that. And when you have rapid hikes that aren't taking business needs into account, that's when you start putting jobs at risk. So, you know, disappointed actually on quite a few fronts. If there is something to highlight that I think was really positive, the Brexit red tape challenge I think is long overdue, and this government does seem to recognize and already has recognized, say, in the planning sector to get more homes built, that you do have to tackle some of that red tape to get the productivity boosts and growth boosts that you want to see.
So Javid's pledge about the minimum wage might not have been that attractive to very traditional Conservatives and the activist base, but is it electorally smart, Ryan, to be parking his tanks on Labour's lawn?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the narrative has been sort of told that it's, you know, we're going to have a kind of Singapore on Thames approach post-Brexit, and it's sort of libertarianism on steroids. And of course, you know, the announcements this week show that that isn't the case. And I think what's driving that is that the voters that Boris needs to secure a majority are in those northern and midland seats, which are not attracted to that kind of small state philosophy as much. I mean, on the minimum wage, I agree with Kate. I think, you know, the gradual rise in it should be underpinned by evidence from the Low Pay Commission, and I think that's very important. I mean, interestingly, even George Osborne's hike, which was done outside the LPC, that hasn't had the impact on job supply, detrimental impact on job supply that I think some libertarians would fear. But of course, if we're going to sustain popular support for the increase in the minimum wage, then what we don't want to do is do it too much, and then that does start to have an impact, because then we lose the popular support for it. So I think that's really important. That, I mean, I'm very positive about increasing the minimum wage. I think it's generally good for productivity, but I think it needs to be carefully done so we don't undermine the consensus across politics that has emerged around it.
You do also have to remember, it's not just about jobs lost overnight, but jobs that are then not created. And, you know, with UK growth being relatively stagnant and woeful compared to a place like the US, it's these kinds of policies that do absolutely nothing to get it ticking up.
Outside of these spending plans, the Home Secretary Priti Patel spoke about her promise to end free movement of people once and for all, stating that the Tory party will be the party of law and order once again. And to do this, she plans on introducing an Australian-style points-based immigration system. Lisa, what do you make of that? Is it all rhetoric, this sort of positioning the Conservatives as being tough on crime, or is there some detail behind that that's going to be...
Well, Priti Patel's speech was absolutely as to be expected, wasn't it? Tough on crime rather than prevention of crime. But what was interesting was I went to an immigration session just a couple of hours before, which speaks to the point about the speech and the promises about low wages, etc., which to me is a great big diversion and an inevitable diversion from the real issue is what happens if Britain crashes out of the EU, GDP is in danger of falling. We are certainly seeing the loss of EU citizens. And at this immigration session, a woman called Julie Onslow Cole, who used to work at PwC and is now working with Fragman, one of the big immigration lawyers who I would talk to quite a lot, said the Australian point system is an absolute red herring, that it's used in a very limited way in Australia. It's used in areas where they find it very difficult to hire people, you know, out in the sticks, etc., and that it doesn't apply to the UK.
I mean, I'm originally from the USA. I'm here on a Tier 2 visa, and I can say firsthand as a non-EU migrant how terrible, complex and difficult the current system is. This idea that people can just come here and just take benefits is absolute nonsense. We do need immigration overhaul in the UK. I'm not convinced at all that the Australian points-based system is the way to go. First and foremost, it assumes that the state's always going to be able to know and plan the labour needs of the economy now and down the road. And I think really that should be left to business. I mean, obviously, as a free marketeer, if you believe in the transfer of goods and services over borders quite easily, you apply that to people as well. And I do think there's a lot of merit in a country, you know, taking back control, to use the key term, of knowing who comes in and how and when. But I'm hopeful, perhaps naively so, that the Conservatives will recognize that post-Brexit, they need to adopt some form of liberal immigration system for many reasons. You know, there are economic and cultural benefits to immigration, but looking at the cost of pensions and healthcare alone, you need young people coming in, paying taxes and propping up those public services. I've been pleased to see that on the student front, they are liberalising a bit, and I hope they continue to move in that direction.
And Ryan, what about her using Thatcher so much as an inspiration in her speech? Was it a speech that was slightly light on the plans and heavy on the strong rhetoric and to appeal to the base?
Yeah, I think it was quite hard line on rhetoric, which is, I think, you know, very much pretty style. I mean, interestingly, you know, they talk about the Australian points-based immigration system. That comes up, the public are very aware of that and think it's, you know, they like it, I suppose, for two reasons. One, they see it as quite hard line. And second, they see it as differentiating between skilled and unskilled workers. And the public are obviously much more positive about skilled workers than they are than unskilled workers and want that differentiation. But of course, the thing about the Australian points-based immigration system is, you know, despite the sense that it's hardline, it's actually increasing levels of immigration in Australia, and it's designed to do that. You know, and interestingly, I think pretty, despite the hardline rhetoric, actually the government, as Kate said, I think encouragingly, has been moving in a more positive direction on immigration. For example, extending the amount of time that students can stay in the UK after their course ends, Boris has also said that he's going to scrap the net migration target, the entrepreneurs and scientists, the cap that existed for their tier one visas, that's being removed as well. So again, you know, there's this thing going on where Boris is perceived as having quite a hardline approach on Brexit. And so to compensate, there are some policy areas like immigration and the environment where he's actually going in a more, you know, what would some would describe as a more liberal, softer direction.
What about this focus on being a party of law and order? Do you think that will actually hold any weight with voters, given that there's been years and years of cuts to policing?
I think that will play well with the grassroots. There have been cuts to police. Not every community will be feeling that, but the ones that do are probably feeling it in quite a severe way. And it's always been a strong talking point for the Conservative Party, and I don't see any reason why that would change now.
It was a subject, though, on which Theresa May was hammered at the last election, along with schools cuts. Do you think that going into an election, fighting on some traditionally Labour territory of public services, the NHS and funding schools, will actually be successful if this is an election for after Brexit's been done?
Well, I mean, people who try and guess on the outcomes of elections always get egg on their face. So I'm not going to try that. But you can see the strategy, and Dominic Cummings, you know, written those very long, interesting blogs. And, you know, he says from the focus groups that he's done, the four priorities for reaching those types of voters. One is investing in public services, particularly key ones like the NHS and schools. The second, a points-based immigration system. Thirdly, tax cuts focused on the lowest paid. And then fourthly, and finally, tough on law and order. And, you know, it's not only the sentencing stuff that you've seen changes around, but stop and search as well, because Theresa May, she was quite hardline on immigration, but on stop and search, she felt that that was disproportionately targeted at people from BME backgrounds. She wanted the police to bring down the levels of stop and search, which, of course, Boris and Sajid have reversed and you know, want to use stop and search much more. And, you know, interestingly, the evidence is not that strong on stop and search in the way that it deters crime or reduces crime levels. I'm not sure the evidence is that solid that increased use of stop and search does that.
Well, that is all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Lisa O'Carroll, Ryan Shorthouse, Kate Andrews and Peter Walker. The producer was Danielle Stevens, and thanks to Elizabeth Cassin. I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.